all the same length. The only thing that changes from a typical disc cone is just that additional top element, which gives it low band, better low band performance. Back to you, Dick.
What I think is the answer to your question, Joe, is that all antennas on VHF, UHF frequencies become considerably more broadband as you make the radiating element electronically more larger in diameter. You don't necessarily have to have the diameter across the whole length. As you do make the diameter larger across more and more of the length, the bandwidth increases. The three-element patent that you may have seen, I could give you the patent number when you actually see this thing made out of sheet metal. It's a three-element Yagi for 915 megacycles, where I made the elements, which normally the elements would be 1/8 of an inch, 1/16 of an inch in diameter. I made them 1/2 inch and 3/4 of an inch in diameter equivalent by making them out of copper foil on a sheet of plastic. So each of the elements of this Yagi are 1/2 an inch or 3/4 of an inch wide, three of those elements. The net result is that an antenna that would have a beautiful visual at 915, but at 902 and 928, its visual would go up to, let's say, 2:1. When I made them as wide as I did and properly tuned them, I had minus 20 dBm return loss, 902 to 928 inclusive. Minus 20 dBm across the whole damn band as a three-element Yagi with 6.2 dB of gain over ISO across that whole band, just by making them wide. The disc cone you're talking about has the equivalent of greater diameter of the radiating element. That gives it more bandwidth. The length of the element and its resonant frequency becomes, let me drop. If I simplistically look at only the length of the element and say that's a quarter wavelength at this frequency and it's only going to work well at that frequency, not necessarily true. You make the element wide enough, you'll be amazed what kind of bandwidth you can get. I can show you another patent for another antenna at 915 megacycles. Instead of being 24 megahertz wide, 20 dB down, it is 150 megahertz wide, 20 dB down, centered at 915. There's a huge benefit you get out of wide radiating elements. That's the good news. You have a well-tuned vector network analyzer while you're doing this experiment at 915 megs with sheets of with a copper tape on a sheet of plastic, and you're putting these tabs of copper tape on and watching the screen while you're doing it. You'll eventually come up with these huge performance antennas in bandwidth with no sacrifice in gain, and the visual bandwidth starts to become extremely wide. That's the good news. Let me drop. The bad news is that all currently available modeling programs that I'm aware of cannot model these super wide element antennas. They give you a trend of greater bandwidth, but the predicted bandwidth by the modeling program and the real bandwidth you get is hugely different, 2:1, 3:1, 5:1 different. Therefore, the claim of all of the classes that teach, the students are being taught in electrical engineering classes these days, their extreme love of computer-aided design is such that essentially every single antenna vendor these days brags about the fact we have such faith in our computer modeling programs, we model it first and then build it. They never do the ham radio experiment on a well-tuned vector network analyzer with real-time display, with sheets, with little dabs of copper in their hand, dabbing it onto a sheet of plastic. They will never find these designs that I've got those two patents on. You're seeing that result, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2TTT.
TTT, you're quite noisy, and you're probably only in a good spot for a short period of time. Go ahead and make your transmission.
Okay, I'll make my transmission short. You're so right, but I can tell you where I work, which is AT&T, we still, you know, will verify and or tweak designs with a computer. But in point of fact, a lot of designs came up out of thin air and were prototyped before modeled. Because sometimes the modeling takes a long time to do as well. The other point about the earlier conversation about frequency, reallocation, T-band, etc., all I can say is anytime you add another carrier to an environment, the intermod becomes that much more interesting. It's service agnostic. And so people wanting to pack more and more and more is going to be very exciting. And when you get to 5G, it's not going to be any better, even though you're going to have hundreds of megahertz of bandwidth, because you'll have self-intermod generation. You'll have subcarrier A and subcarrier B and something else, et cetera, fighting you in your own input, let alone other inputs. So, you know, buyer beware and buckle up. As I like to say, the simplistic intermod model of 2X minus Y will certainly bite somebody. And that's the most simplistic intermod model you can find, short of a simple harmonic. Anyway, W2TTT, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Gordon. As you start packing more and more carriers into the same frequency region on the same site, like the top of the building, the number of intermods probably goes up close to square law of the number of carriers you're putting there. So you double the number of carriers, you probably have four times as many intermod capabilities. So many of these schemes to pack things in tight and get more in the same spectrum is probably a bit naive, and it's going to create some problems in the future. On your first subject, when it comes to computer modeling, and you think you can increase the design performance by taking a design and then computer modeling it, if you're using relatively narrow elements, that will probably work. When you're getting into these wide elements because you want a whole lot of standing wave ratio bandwidth as well as gain bandwidth, your ability to computer model it goes down. And part of what's going on here, to answer Joe's question, let me drop. My personal belief as to what's happening, when you make the individual radiating elements wide, large in diameter or wide, and RF-wise it doesn't make any difference whether you do it with a flat piece of sheet metal that's wide or you truly do it with a round element, the performance is almost the same. The real cross-sectional radius is what really counts, or diameter is what really counts. And that signal can now go down that wide element by not only going straight down the middle, but it has the ability to zigzag as well because of the extra width. That's part of the mechanism, I believe, of where the extra bandwidth is coming from. So you get this huge improvement when you increase the bandwidth of the you increase the diameter of the radiating element. And because the computer modeling programs cannot handle it, most people don't know this. It's something that the ham radio operators, with their tweaking, with a good vector network analyzer, will find it immediately as long as they get the faith to go look for it. But by way of the classes and the books and the popular theory on antenna design these days, by those techniques, they will never find it. W2RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, you see, you keep on talking about antenna diameter of the elements. The antenna diameter, the diameter of the elements on this disc cone are only about maybe an eighth or a little, I think maybe, let's see, what's eighth and quarter, like five sixteenths, give or take? Somewhere around there. I believe they're about 5/16 diameter elements are hollow. The good lower elements that are connected to the ground part of the antenna, those are, look like they're about 35 inches long. There's about, I don't know, like eight of them, I think, eight or ten of them. But the top element, the other ones that come out horizontally are much, much shorter, about either 6 or 8 inches. So they're not very wide in diameter by themselves, but this is why I was a little, you know, just wondering how. I mean, it's just this kind of antenna, I think it's been around for a long, long time. It's probably been used by the military for various things, for field use, to be able to put up their stuff and make it work reasonably well on many, many frequency bands simultaneously. But it's just kind of interesting that when you look at it, it has very deep return loss in some parts of some bands and not so good in other parts of other bands.
Yeah, but you're discounting the fact that the wires are an approximation of a conic section.
Joe, in the old days when you built a disc cone antenna, the center radiating element was a sheet metal cone where the apex of the cone is probably a 30-degree angle. The sharp point of the cone was down, touching the ground plane, and the upper portion of it was the wide-diameter cone made out of sheet metal. The skeleton version of that these days is that you use a whole bunch of individual eighth-inch diameter rods to make a skeleton equivalent of that cone. When you do that properly, the fact that it's not one solid piece of sheet metal, but it's eight individual rods in a conic display technique, the RF sees that almost as that sheet metal cone. You get the benefit, you get 90% of the benefit of the real sheet metal. The individual diameters of the individual rods of the center radiator no longer counts as long as a whole lot of them close to each other. That RF wave sees it as one large blob, conic-shaped object. That's if it's truly a disc cone antenna. If it doesn't have that property I've just described, it's not a disc cone. Over to you, Joe, K2IW.
Okay, then how would you explain the performance compared to an antenna cut properly for a certain part of the band and used even out of that band? The other antenna, like my monopole antenna, just seems to perform better on some parts, like 50 megahertz, for example. I mean, I could try it around 50.1, 50.13, so forth, which is on today. And on every station I heard, when it went to the monopole, compared to the disco and the monopole, even though it's not cut to the band, always heard them a little better. And when I transmit to one or two people down there, they heard me better on the monopole than the disco.
Repeater, timeout.
Eric first, K2EJ, go ahead, Eric, and I'll try to get back to that one. It's not an easy one.
I wanted to let you know that the audience has grown. We've got the station in Toronto connected to us. We've got Boston, Texas, and also on Echolink, I don't know if this is the guy that you're looking for. He's got KB2CLI. He's got Steve in Florida and a whole bunch of other folks. You might want to take a moment and see if anybody wants to add their name to the list.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that to our attention, Eric. As I said at the beginning of the introduction for this TechNet tonight, either this weekend or next weekend, we believe we're going to get some sign-ins from the other TechNet, which takes place in Boca Raton, Florida. And so we know that they have the capability of either hooking up with us by Echolink or IRLP. So let's see if we do have any check-ins from Boca Raton, Florida. If so, give me your call letters and name right now, after the four beeps. K2RIW, TechNet, Long Island. My name is Dick. We're listening. Okay, maybe they're not prepared to chime in, to sign in and join our TechNet tonight yet. And maybe they'll be doing that later on tonight or next week. Now, you're getting different performance on different out-of-band frequencies on these two different antennas, and you're asking me, why is that happening? When I build two different antennas by two different techniques, you're going to have peaks and valleys in performance of viswire and gain all over the place. I presume that the specified frequency region over which the disc cone is rated for and the specified frequency of which your monopole is rated for are very different, and different methods of construction. So you're asking me why the different antennas behave differently. Why is the number four bigger than the number two? I mean, there is no good answer for that. Every antenna, if you can model it thoroughly enough, in theory, except for these very broadband radiating antennas, you can predict where the gain. Every antenna has at least, bandwidth-wise, it's got at least two different bandwidths. It's got a bandwidth over which it gives you the gain that you like. It's got a bandwidth over which it gives you the standing wave ratio that you like. And those two different bandwidths need not track each other. So on the frequencies where it's not working so well, is it not working so well because of high standing wave ratio or because of low gain or a pattern that got distorted that didn't favor the horizon that you're trying to listen to? So pattern change, gain change, standing wave ratio change, different design of antenna change and changing frequency. You're asking me why is there a difference? There is no simple answer to that, and I think you can see why, Joe. W-A-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Well, I thought the antenna wouldn't work and the SSB part of the band would actually work better than I thought it was going to be, so that's pretty much it. I guess I'm just going to have to accept it is what it is, and how it works is how it works. It could be maybe physical place when the antennas are about 20 feet apart, give or take. It could have been that in some cases where one station coming in is not favoring, you know, one antenna could be the other, just as far as being maybe one or two wavelengths away or something like that. I don't know. But I thought I'd just bring it up with the question. All right, you can go for the next guy who on your list, W-H-Y-Y.
The possibility that the two antennas you're comparing, Joe, a disc cone and a monopole, are 10 or 20 feet apart, may not be at the exact same altitude, but multipath is always present. Take a weak repeater you're listening to into your handy-talkie, and you walk around your living room with that handy-talkie. Move the handy-talkie left, right, up, down, forward and back, and twist it horizontally. You'll find all kinds of peaks and valleys within your living room on 2 meters into a handy-talkie because of multipath. That signal is bouncing off of the wiring of your house, the downspout gutters, the gutters themselves, the reflection off the file cabinet that's in the corner and so on. That radio signal is bouncing off of every single object that's in your environment. That signal that gets to your handy-talkie antenna arrives there by 1 million individual paths. And each one of those paths has got its own amplitude and phase, and they're all being added together in a vector manner at your handy-talkie rubber duck, if you know what I mean, for that particular position. Let me drop. Now, that's the multipath you're going to get in your living room with a handy-talkie. With antennas on the roof of your house, the amount of multipath is a little bit decreased. But still, if those two antennas were on the roof, were mounted on rails so that you could slide them across the peak of the roof while watching signal strength, you'd see a very interesting strip shot recording of peaks and valleys, if you know what I mean, for that particular station you're listening to coming from that particular azimuth location. Choose another station from another azimuth location and slide the antenna on that rail across the roof, and you'll get an entirely different curve. RF is strange. Very few people recognize how prevalent multipath is. It's always there. You transmit a signal from an antenna. That signal comes out of the antenna in all possible directions. The signal is radiating an isotropic antenna, every possible azimuth and elevation. The only thing left to discuss is what's the amplitude of the signal in that particular azimuth and that particular elevation. But the signal is radiated in all directions from your antenna at some particular signal strength. Let me drop. And those signals, zillions of signals coming out of your transmitting antenna hits every single object in your environment that you can see, and a hell of a lot of objects that you cannot see. It's hitting all of those and bouncing, including the water tower that's half a mile away, if you know what I mean. So once you include multipath, you suddenly realize that if you really want to measure the performance of an antenna and you want it to be traceable to the Bureau, you're either going to be doing it on a very well-engineered reflective ground plane range antenna range at VHF frequencies. At UHF and up frequencies, you're going to use a very well-designed anechoic chamber if you want documented performance of an antenna, of a gain performance, traceable to the Bureau. When you test an amplifier on the bench, you can measure its gain, its phase characteristics, its overload, its distortion. You can measure all kinds of things of an amplifier. You decide to measure an antenna. You think you're measuring the antenna. You're measuring the antenna and the environment around the antenna simultaneously mishmashed together in every case. You're measuring the environment of the antenna as well as the antenna. A hell of a lot of people don't realize that. They see a crazy performance in this particular environment, and they think the antenna all by itself has crazy performance. In some cases, the answer is absolutely not. There's a lot more to that story. Good antenna range, repeatable performance is an art form, that the thousands of words and thousands of articles have been written on that. You can read many of those articles in the monthly journal of the IEEE called Antennas and Propagation, Special Technical Group. Let me drop. Of which I am a senior life member. Okay, the next person who is on our list, and I hope David is still with us, N2 Alpha Alpha Mike. Hope we haven't put you to sleep, Dave. N2 AAM, K2LAW in the TechNet. You got it, Dave.
Okay, Dick, K2LAW in the net. This is N2 AAM. No, you're not putting me to sleep. It's enjoyable and interesting. It always is. Question for you, if I can digress to a topic that you covered about 2 weeks ago on the net. You talked about smaller sized antennas, and you could resonate almost anything with an antenna tuner. Now, my question is to you, it's almost counterintuitive, because you say that if you tune it up correctly with the right tuner, you can get incredibly good efficiency on an antenna, but if it's very off-sized, let's say much smaller than what it is, it's counterintuitive. Then if that's the reason, then why do we strive as amateurs and people in the professional side of the industry strive to set up antennas that are perfect size to the band, cut to resonate, when we could just set up anything through an antenna tuner? Maybe I'm rambling here, but you just kind of opened up a couple of interesting mental exercises a couple weeks ago.
That's a good question, Dave, and it bears repeating every month, in my opinion, because it's opposite of common sense. Arguably, one of the Bibles of antenna design, one of the best books ever written on the subject, is a book by John Krauss, W-H-A-K, who was the head of the electrical engineering department at Ohio, I think it's Ohio University or University of Ohio, anyhow, over there in Miamisburg, Ohio. That particular textbook, 1950 McGraw-Hill Antennas, which is edition number one of the three editions of Krauss's book called Antennas. You go to the chapter entitled The Infinitesimal Dipole. He tells you in no uncertain words that is, you take the half wavelength dipole, and shrink it down to an infinitesimal size. He admits the standing wave ratio goes to hell and gone real fast. And if you just simply connect that antenna with a transmission line to a transmitter and a receiver, off of resonance, you're going to get terrible performance. Not because the antenna has terrible performance. It's because the standing wave ratio is something your transmitter and receiver cannot tolerate. The antenna itself has the infinitesimal dipole, never loses more than 0.4 dB of gain compared to a full-size half-wave dipole. You shrink it down to an infinitesimal size, you never lose more than 0.4 dB of gain if you resonate it. And the antenna tuner has to be very broadband, very high in performance, in order to resonate it. But by various techniques, by putting a loading coil, helical winding, zigzagging, top hat capacitors, high mu materials nearby, by using all the techniques by which you can take a very small length antenna and re-resonate it, an antenna tuner, an LC network you've added, and so on, once you bring it back into resonance, even though the size is infinitesimal, within 0.4 dB, you come back to the exact same gain, the exact same effective area, the exact same transmitting gain, receiving gain, effective capture area. Of course, that's opposite of common sense. If I'm building a half-wave dipole on 80 meters, it should be 132 feet long out of, say, a 14-gauge wire. If I shrink it down to 30 feet instead of 132 feet, by way of the Brown and Woodward curves, which you can find in the articles on the two websites, which one is called amateurradio.tangovictor, and the other one is LimarkTechNet.com. By either of those sites, you looked at the article by K2LIW and getting good impedance match of a dipole, you'll find these Brown and Woodward curves. Once you know the diameter of the radiator and the length of the radiator, you go to the curve by Mr. Brown and Woodward. Back in 1946, Bell Laboratories, they made some extremely good measurements of every possible length of a monopole or dipole. Let me drop. So once you know the diameter and the length of your particular wire and the frequency you're operating at, your radiator, you can predict exactly what the resistive component and what the reactive component is going to be. When it's a half wavelength long, the reactive component goes to zero, and the resistive component for a monopole is something like 32 ohms. Dipole is something like 37 ohms. Dipole is 72 ohms. As you make the length very short, the resistive component starts going towards zero, and the reactive component becomes highly capacitive. Now, this is where it goes to infinity real fast. But if you re-resonate it, if you re-impedance match it with a perfect antenna tuner, at least at that particular narrow band frequency, you'll get full performance within 4/10 of a dB. And the 4/10 of a dB is not efficiency change. It's a very slight shift in the pattern. The donut pattern becomes a little fatter. That's why the 4/10 of a dB decrease when you go to infinitesimal size. The Q goes to infinity when you shrink it real small. Let me drop. Instead of your 80-meter dipole being 300 kc wide, it may be only 3 kc wide if you make it short enough. Very high in Q. You QSY a little bit, and you're going to have to retune the daylights out of your antenna tuner. And the antenna tuner better be mounted right at the antenna and very high performance and very broadband. You mount the antenna tuner in the shack where your coax cable is now, even though it's a piece of RG8 on 80 meters, because it's 100 feet long and it's got 7/10 of a dB of gain with matched impedance on both ends, because it's running into 101 Viswa, the 7/10 of a dB of gain becomes 17 dB, 7/10 of a dB of loss becomes 17 dB of loss. And you'll think the antenna's got terrible performance. It's not the antenna with terrible performance. It's the transmission line that has the signal bouncing back and forth and a whole lot of loss on each bounce and hundreds of bounces and therefore a whole lot of loss. Now, what doesn't make sense is how can you think that what you see with your eye is related to the effective capture area. Absolutely not. When that antenna is infinitesimal in size and very high in Q, it's got this huge reactive magnetic field around that antenna. The RF energy being received sees that great big field. It sees the great big effective capture area that your eye does not see. It's there because of the high Q. You either can make the effective capture area there because the physical length is there, or when you re-resonate it, the effective capture area comes back because of this huge magnetic field you've designed around that antenna in the process of resonating it. Every dipole, let me drop. You'd like to think that when the dipole is a half wavelength long and you put that signal into it by way of your transmission line, you'd like to believe the signal goes out of a dipole and then jumps into space. Absolutely not. Even the perfect half-wave dipole, the signal bounces back and forth 10 times before it finally gets radiated. If it's a half-wavelength long, all of those 10 bounces are in step with each other. We call that resonance. You make the dipole shorter, the signal bounces back and forth larger number of times, and each of those bounces are no longer in step with each other. The signal goes down and comes back too soon. We call that phase shift of the signal coming back too soon, we call that capacitive reactance. And if you don't correct that capacitive reactance with an antenna tuner of some kind, the visual will disturb the rest of your equipment, something fierce. So what really happens into an antenna, whether it's a half wavelength long or whether it's some infinitesimal wavelength with a resonator, an antenna tuner, what really happens is you must, to get good performance, you're going to resonate that radiating system. Radiating system is the dipole, antenna tuner, impedance matching devices, loading coil, and all the other and top hat capacitors, helical winding, zigzagging, all of that jazz. You're going to resonate that antenna radiating structure. The bottom line, the seven most important words in the English language if you're an antenna designer is you resonate first, then it will radiate. I know of no book that says those words. I know of no instructor that says those words. If you're an antenna designer and you want it to work, those words are very important. If you want the antenna to radiate, you will resonate it first if it is a so-called standing wave structure. Let me drop. The one exception to that is a rhombic antenna or a Beveridge antenna, an antenna that is a zillion wavelengths long where the signal goes down the antenna once and goes into a loading resistor. That's the only antenna that doesn't have this signal bouncing back and forth until it gets radiated. All reasonable half-wavelength size antennas have the signal bouncing back and forth a whole lot of times before it gets radiated. Radiation is hard. You've got to kick that signal in the tail 10 times in a row before it finally leaves on a half-wavelength dipole. On a 10th wavelength dipole, you probably have to bounce the signal back and forth 100 times. It probably has a 50-to-1 standing wave ratio before it finally gets radiated. But once you resonate it, and it takes a whole lot of strong magnetic field and a lot of bouncing signals to resonate an infinitesimal dipole, but that great big field you create reinstates that effective capture area. You measure the real performance. Once you re-resonated it with high-performance tuning network, all that gain comes back. Your cell phone that you're using today is doing that. There is an antenna tuning integrated circuit chip alongside of that antenna inside of your cell phone. That's how it operates on all those frequencies with that small antenna all internally contained. That antenna must radiate, must resonate. I know you've got to hear these things a number of times before it makes any sense, Dave, because a lot of it is opposite of common sense. I've been designing antennas for 35, 40 years, and this philosophy, these words, has worked for me. Not everybody's going to agree with it. N2AAM, K2RAW, you can ask more questions if you like, Dave.
Yeah, okay, K2RAW, and the net, this is N2AAM. This, what you've just said, brings up a couple of more questions. Number one, then why haven't the major antenna manufacturers of all types taken advantage of this and says only a difference of 0.4 of a dB with a, either, let's say, a half-wave dipole or a resonated tuned smaller antenna? I would think that saving space at commercial antenna sites, amateur sites, things like that, have just made resonant systems with much smaller antennas, which would economically be even more cost-effective because less materials are used in making the antennas.
Okay, the answer to your question, Dave, is what I told you is absolutely possible within the laws of physics. I didn't say it's convenient. A full half-wave antenna on 80 meters probably has at least 300 kilohertz of bandwidth at the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio points with normal methods of construction. You make that 80-meter dipole that should be 132 feet long, and you make it 32 feet long instead. Instead of it being 300 kc wide, it's now 3 kc wide. Every time you QSY 3 kc, you've got to retune the daylights out of your remotely tuned antenna tuner located at the dipole. So small antennas could save you a little bit of money, could save you some real estate on the product that you're producing, but now you, the disadvantage of a small antenna is the Q climbs exponentially. You half the length of the antenna, and you've got a hell of a lot more Q in a hurry. The Brown and Woodward curves will tell you exactly what the Q is going to be once you understand the mathematics. So because the antenna becomes so narrowband, because every time you change the frequency, you've got to do a whole lot of retuning, that is very inconvenient if you've got a broadband system. So you pay your money, you take your choice. You don't get something for nothing here. You can make the infinitesimal dipole give you full performance if you're willing to put forth the effort. Let me drop. Of building the broadband antenna tuner, resonating it, and impedance matching it at that operating frequency. And you're willing to change the daylights out of that network when you QSY that frequency. So that becomes very inconvenient for a broadband system. So you don't get the performance for nothing. You can shrink it infinitesimally, but boy, you're going to work real hard to bring it back to full performance. And you and I can do that because we amateur radio operators instantaneously usually live at narrowband frequencies. Many commercial systems, say a cell phone, must hop around to a whole bunch of frequencies. They don't have that that luxury unless they've got a very high-performance antenna tuning integrated circuit chip mounted right at that antenna, and that's what your cell phone does have. Does that answer your question, Dave? N2AAM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it does, Dick, and as a matter of fact, it just goes to show you, in the laws of physics, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. And I had a feeling that your answer would be something like that, because when you mentioned the infinitesimal dipole, I was thinking about it and realized that how counterintuitive is that if you analyze it the way you just did, it does make sense. And, you know, once in a while, it's good to revisit these concepts and exercise your mind. And thanks a lot for providing me mental exercise and answering my question. I've listened to the net since it started, practically, when you and Hip ran it in the early 1980s. And it's been a forum of great worth in the ham community. So thanks a lot for doing what you do. That's about it from here. Back to that, K2RIW. This is N2AAM.
WB2HWW with a comment on this subject.
Zulu with a comment.
Howie recognized and blank Zulu. We'll take you in that order. When it comes to the TechNet, which began September of 1982 with HIP and 2FDJ and I, we expected it to last a month, answer everybody's question, we dry up and go away. We soon discovered that there's always new hams joining the hobby. The methods by which we teach wireless technology to our electrical engineers and so on needs a lot of improvement. The so-called way of describing Maxwell's equations, and you think that's going to answer all the questions and be useful engineering information, and many courses are taught that way, it almost does not work. The TechNet itself, the last 11 years of the 36 years of its existence, the last 11 years are available for you to play back anytime you want to by going to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. This is a very enthusiastic guy named Mike, KC2NJI, who's been doing that for the last 11 years. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back up to, let's say, there's probably 4,000 hours worth of TechNet there. And so when it comes to antennas, let me drop. We radio engineers, we ham radio operators, are enthralled with the wireless technology, the action at a distance. You put 5 watts into an antenna, and in theory, on Morse code, on 80 meters, when the band is in good shape, you talk to a guy on the other side of the world. The magic of that enthralls the daylights out of that. All of that doesn't work without an antenna. Gold-plated transmitter and a platinum-plated receiver connected to a non-antenna gets you nowhere. Arguably, the antenna is the most important part of the project. The antenna is the hardest thing in the world to understand because of the way we teach or don't teach that particular science. Many of the books do a very poor job. You talk to a guy who has worked with the antenna engineering department of a good company, and he's got 10 years of service, 10 years of experience, or 20 years of experience, or apprenticeship. He's got 10 or 20 years of apprenticeship, and you'll find out that he does his operation not by Maxwell's equations, not by computer modeling, by a whole bunch of rules of thumb that he has developed over the 10 or 20 years of his apprenticeship. He knows if the antenna tunes a little bit high in frequency, and if it's a dipole-like antenna, he knows he's going to add some length. He knows if he sees a capacitor reactance, he's going to add an inductor. He knows how to do it by holding a tuning tool, a piece of copper tape on the end of a wooden stick, and how to watch the network analyzer as he holds it near various portions of the antenna. He can arrive at a good design of the antenna by cut-and-try, amateur-like techniques. He can do that in a small number of minutes. He can try to analyze the antenna on a computer modeling program, and it takes him hours. By way of tinkering, he can do it many times in minutes because of his experience. He knows what's going on. He knows the way the RF behaves. So there's a whole lot of, we amateurs are very good at designing antennas. And the antenna arguably is the most important part of the system, because without it, you've got nothing in the RF world. And so the number of questions we all have on antennas is huge, because the way it's taught, in my opinion, is so poor compared to the way it should be taught. Go ahead, Howie. W2HWW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Evening, good evening, Dave, on 2 a.m. Dick, I remember TechNet back in 1982. I think it was around for the first or second one when you had it on 00. It's only a couple hours back yet, back in 1982. A lot of water under the bridge. Okay, my comment is this. Dave is in the, Dave is on the broadcast station. Dave can tell you that. He owned the station outside there in Washington or Virginia, an AM broadcast station. One of the things is when you start getting down to the AM broadcast band and you try to make an antenna smaller, your bandwidth, like you say, your Q is going to go almost, it's going to be very large, almost infinite. And what's going to happen is it's going to affect your bandwidth. So if you're trying to modulate a 5K signal up and down, 10K is a complete signal up on lower sidebands on an AM double carrier, you're going to start to affect it. Believe it or not, when you're in Europe and you listen to long wave at 200K or 300K, those stations sometimes sound distorted, or they sound, their highs get cut off. So that's a problem you have. When you get down to those real low frequencies that you know, Dick, that's another reason why. So, yeah, you could probably make the antenna not 30 feet long, but maybe a quarter wave or maybe 5/8. So a quarter wave or a little less than a quarter wave. But you make it so small, as you say, the bandwidth is just going to be too narrow. You probably would have to use other techniques in your tuning structure to try to get some bandwidth. Back to you, Dick.
Yes, there are equalizer networks you can add to the antenna. I didn't say it's easy. It may require some great big inductors and capacitors and whatever. At broadcast level of power, it could be very difficult. But you could make it a triple-tuned bandpass filter, your antenna, so to speak. There's ways you can broaden the antenna. You can also use an equalizer network when it comes to the audio, where you pre-emphasize the higher frequencies that are being rolled off by the bandwidth of the antenna. So there's ways you can compensate up to a point. You're not going to take an AM broadcast antenna that you'd like to be 900 feet tall and make it 9 feet tall. You can't take it that far. And by the way, if you did do that, the Q would get so high, and there's five different definitions of Q. One of the definitions is the voltage rise at resonance. Another one is the current rise at resonance. Another one is the bandwidth divided by center frequency, divided into center frequency. Another one is energy stored per cycle, energy dissipated per cycle. It sounds like five different phenomena. It's really the exact same phenomena, five different ways of measuring it. Let me drop. But you take an AM broadcast monopole antenna that you'd like to be 900 feet tall, and you make it 9 feet tall. At low power levels, with the right kind of a tuning network, you can make that give very close to full performance, with the slight exception that now your radiation center is so close to the ground, how well you're going to copy, how well the broadcast signal is going to be heard 30 miles away is another problem here. The radiation center altitude, if you know what I mean. But you now start putting 10 kilowatts into that, because it's got a Q of 100, and the instantaneous voltage on the tip of the antenna will arc over to the air. There are guys who have tried to take an 80-meter monopole on their automobile, shrink it down to a small size, and put 200 watts into it, and as they talk on sideband, the corona they get off the tip of the antenna allows them to hear the voice acoustically from the sparking that's coming from the tip of the antenna. So the high Q you're going to get, you make the antenna have a Q of 100, the normal voltage on the antenna is going to get 100 times higher, and you're going to arc over to the air. So you've got some other laws of physics you're going to live with when you start making the antenna small. There was another person who signed in after Howie. Who was that person? Because you were so quick on the switch, we only heard the last letter. I think it was Uncle. Over to you. Give me your full call, letters, and name. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, W2BZ, the name is Rich. Can you hear me okay, Dick?
Yes, I do hear you very well, Rich. You're 80% audio, 20% noise, but you sound good. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, back in the late 90s, I had an acre and a half of land to play with, and I researched the hell out of what wire I should put up, and overwhelmingly it came out as a loop antenna. Now, you said over and over again that a dipole and a loop perform the exact same way, but is that true in terms of directionality and the parameter? Because that's not what my research on the air, on the low bands, and whatever else on the internet. But you've always said they're exactly the same in performance and I think directionality.
If I did say that, that probably was wrong. A loop antenna and a dipole antenna are each capable of 100% efficiency. They're each capable of nearly the exact same amount of gain. That's the good news. But now, if I'm comparing a loop antenna that's parallel to the ground to a vertical monopole antenna, they both have an omnidirectional pattern out to the horizon, but one is vertically polarized and one is horizontally polarized, so the comparison becomes very difficult. If I take the plane of the loop and tilt it so that it's now perpendicular to the ground, at least in the north-south direction, so to speak, if that's the plane of the loop, I will have very close to the exact same gain as the monopole when I'm talking strictly north and south. East and west, I'm going to have a no in the pattern from the loop. So because the patterns and polarizations are so difficult, even though the efficiencies are the same, it's a difficult comparison. So in any reasonable installation, if I've got one each in my backyard and I flip back and forth between the two, depending on the polarization of the signal I'm listening to and the azimuthal direction of arrival, most of the time I'm going to see a huge difference because of those differences in pattern. That the loop antenna tends to radiate, if the loop is small in diameter, it tends to radiate in the plane of the loop and in the and of the polarization of the wire of the loop. The plane of the loop gives you both the polarization and the directions of transmission. But it's horizontally polarized when it's parallel to the ground. So it's a difficult comparison. If I was properly orienting the loop in free space, and I peaked it up for a signal being received on the ground from my satellite, and I did the same thing with a dipole, I would think that the two antennas have the same amount of gain. But I'd have to be careful on how I orient each one of them to peak it up for the direction that's desirable. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, though, Rich. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is W2BZ. Dick, I wasn't talking about a vertical comparison. I was talking about a dipole versus a loop comparison.
Okay. If the loop is small in diameter and it is forced into resonance with a tuning capacitor at the open end, so to speak, then the pattern of the dipole and the pattern of the loop, broadside to the dipole and the pattern of the loop, are very similar. As the loop becomes larger in diameter so that you have less and less of a loading capacitor, it starts developing a antenna pattern which becomes more and more like a dipole, if you know what I mean. So a horizontal loop and a horizontal dipole could be fairly similar, but now because of multipath, in order to do a comparison, you'd have to make sure that you're finding the gain peak of each of those antennas. And because they might be at a slightly different altitude and a slightly different location on your property, because of multipath, the comparison becomes kind of difficult. When you compared the two, what did you see as the difference, Dave? Rich, W2BZ, K2RIW?
Well, I didn't, because I did not put up a dipole. This is a full-wave length loop on 40. Up about 30 feet, I would say, as parallel as I could get it to the ground. I just thought that it was so much more omnidirectional than a dipole would be, that it would just, you know, communication-wise, make a lot more keystrokes. Let me put it that basically, than a dipole, a comparative dipole, let's say a full-wave dipole on 40 compared to a full-wave loop on 40.
I was waiting for the other beep, which I guess didn't happen. In the case of your full-wave loop on 40, you were real careful to make it parallel to the ground. You didn't have to do that. You can tilt it any way you want to. Because that signal on 40 meters hits the ionosphere. It so-called bounces, which really means refracts off the ionosphere. The ionosphere is a plasma of conductive material with a Earth magnetic field built into the middle of it. Therefore, it will create Faraday rotation. That horizontally polarized signal coming out of your loop antenna, by the time it gets to your buddy you're talking to in London, the signal probably has been twisted in polarization a couple of times because of Faraday rotation, and it could very well arrive in London vertically polarized. The guy in London using a vertical monopole hears you beautifully. He radiates with his monopole back to you, and you think you're going to see a horizontal signal. It turns out that Faraday rotation does not obey the law of reciprocity. The signal going from east to west twists one way due to Faraday rotation. The signal going from west to east twists another way. The possibility exists, let me drop, that you radiate horizontal from New York, from New Jersey, or from the east coast of the United States. It gets to London vertically polarized. He radiates a vertically polarized signal from London, and it comes to you in the United States as a vertically polarized signal after a couple of twists because of Faraday rotation. The bottom line is, go real careful to make sure your loop is parallel to the ground if you want to. You're gilding the lily, because the polarization everybody you talk to is going to get is almost unrelated to the polarization that you radiate. In fact, some of the QSB fades that you get on a long path on HF frequencies is because the ionosphere is moving, the Earth's magnetic field is moving, and therefore the amount of Faraday rotation is changing, and sometimes you're getting cross-polarization that happens periodically. I wonder if it's ever been explained to you that way before, Rich. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Put it this way, I wish I knew that 20 years ago. No, I've never heard that theory. Would that be true of the other bands, you know, tuning it down to like 20 or 15 or whatever, would the rotation be the same?
Each time I pass it back to you, make sure you wait for the beeps, otherwise you might time out the machine, Rich. Will it be the same? No. Faraday rotation decreases as 1 over frequency squared. By the time you get to 2 meters, there almost is no Faraday rotation. From 80 meters to 40 meters, you're going to get a hell of a lot less. From 40 to 20, you're going to get less. You're always going to get some amount of Faraday rotation. You Google the word Faraday rotation and you read the Wikipedia articles on the subject, you get a hell of a lot more information about how much you're going to get for what ionospheric state in what azimuthal direction. You're going to get a different amount of Faraday rotation when you radiate the signal north versus east versus south versus west, if you know what I mean. So it decreases 1 over frequency squared, but to some degree it's always there. Over to you, Rich, W2BZ with the weight, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, now is the same true of a dipole, or the dipole doesn't have any rotation at all?
You're radiating a signal from your QTH with some kind of an antenna. As long as you're going beyond ground wave distance on an HF frequency, you are using the ionosphere. The Faraday rotation is created by the mixture of the plasma called ionosphere plus the Earth's magnetic field. You take plasma plus magnetic field, you're going to get Faraday rotation. You're going to get the fancy word. It's part of the operation by which a microwave circulator or isolator works. Gyrotropy, it's called. So it's the ionosphere that's doing it. what you use as an antenna and its polarization, that's your choice. Whether the signal you radiate is horizontal or vertical, in either case, you're going to get some amount of Faraday rotation. Your next question is, if you radiate a vertical signal toward London, and if you radiate a horizontal signal toward London, will they each get the same amount of Faraday rotation? The answer is no, slightly different. So where you start in azimuth, elevation, latitude, longitude, and polarization, and what direction you're going, in every case is going to give you a slightly different amount of Faraday rotation. But to some degree, if you know the state of the ionosphere today and the state of the magnetic field today and the distance you're talking to and the azimuth you're transmitting the signal, to some degree, if you've got enough of lower ingredients, you can predict the amount of Faraday rotation you're going to get on that particular band. Back to you, Rich, W2BZ, K2LAW.
Yes, the only way to know is have your buddy switch between a horizontal and vertical antenna, correct?
Yes, but even that's going to give you confusing results. You transmit horizontal, and today, at this hour, he receives vertical. He then talks back to you on vertical, and you don't hear him because the signal is coming to you and arrives in your QTH vertical, and your horizontal antenna doesn't pick it up. To really do the experiment correctly, you need a horizontal and a vertical. He needs a horizontal and a vertical, and maybe ways of slowly switching between the two. If you've got a horizontal antenna and a vertical antenna, and if you've got a way of controlling the amplitude and the phase that you send to the two signals simultaneously, in theory, you can make every degree of polarization you want on both transmission and reception. That in itself would be a beautiful experiment. A few guys have done that. I mean, one guy I know had a horizontal and a vertical antenna at his site doing receiving, and two separate receivers, and stereo headphones. The horizontal antenna went into his right-hand earphone, the vertical antenna went into his left-hand earphone, and during QSB fades, he would hear the signal drift back and forth across his head, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Rich, K2LAW.
B2H, Stone, you know me, you want to comment?
The Beatles, Pat and Abbey Road, sending one side to the other. Well, I wish I had this conversation. So that's all I could say. Thank you very much, W2DC.
Yeah, you faded out 50% of the time on that transmission, Rich, but we got the general gist. And yes, it would have been nice to discuss some of these subjects earlier, or when we were all younger so we had more time to experiment with them. HWW, K2LAW. Go ahead, Howie.
Comment I was going to make is if you're able to take a vertical and a horizontal and put them into a voting system, two receivers, you could get rid of this QSB, or if you used, let's say, a couple antennas like an inverted V, one north and south, one east and west, and then put them into a power divider, you could come up with a way of making, like, say, a turnstile or something, an antenna that would receive signals at all angles and all phase angles at once. You could probably reduce the QSB. Go ahead.
You're right, Howie. Of all the QSB fades that we hear on HF frequencies, a good portion of that is Faraday rotation and the variation of Faraday rotation. That's a good portion of it. That's not all of it. Sometimes the signal simply skips over you. It's making a bounce in Ohio and another bounce in the Atlantic Ocean, and it doesn't make a bounce at your neighborhood on the east coast of the United States. So, what's the cause of QSB? The ionosphere truly disappearing, the bounces skipping over you, and Faraday rotation. My gut feel is that Faraday rotation is probably 85% of the QSB, but that's just a gut feel. It's not a scientific study. There probably are people who have really studied it. Okay, we've used up more than the usual amount of time for the question and answer period. It's time we go over to the science talk. Dr. Roy, AC2GS, is going to give us the science. So go right ahead, Roy, K2IW in the TechNet.
Next, much, Dick. I just wanted to mention a few things before I start off. Tom W2RFU, who is the gentleman from Boca Raton, we checked into Echolink around 8:15 to about 8:30 and then checked out. And no one on Echolink actually hears the four beeps. They hear a single tone. I also had the diversity reception, and I heard it relatively